Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in today. This is Red Ice Radio, and I'm Henrik. Today we have Brett Stevens from America.org with us. He's the author of Nihilism, a philosophy based in nothingness and eternity. We're going to talk more about today, in addition, of course, to some of the current events, analysis of the situation in America right now. Now, there might be some differences and even disagreements that we have on certain issues, but that's all right. We never bring on people just to echo the same thoughts over and over. We've always been a show that want to hear different angles, get a different flavor of things, and try to understand things from a different point of view. Not only for the reason, of course, that mainstream media never gives people in the both in the neo-reactionary movement, but also in the alt-right, a fair hearing. So, of course, we have to take on that role and give you an idea to give you a chance to actually know what many people and figures and everything else within this rising movement of resistance actually think about stuff instead of going to the mainstream. So anyway, we've gotten a few requests to get Brett on the show, and I've actually come across your site, America, a number of times in the past, Brett, searching on certain issues. So it's good to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I've enjoyed your show for quite some time. It's good to be on here.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yeah, so if I understand it correctly, you kind of came into a lot of the topics, obviously, that you write about today through the kind of neo-reactionary movement. Tell us a bit about how you ended up there and what led you to start the site.
Well, you know, I actually started out in the 1980s publishing to bulletin board systems, and then through the 90s wrote about right-wing topics, especially inspired by black metal and death metal. As I guess on my first site, which was the American Nihilist Underground Society, I wrote lengthy essays on these topics that were somewhat popular and somewhat defining during the early 2000s and late 1990s. After that point, I cruised around looking for some new areas, and I found economics, and through that, neo-reaction, which seemed to me to be a good extension of the anarcho-capitalist worldview with a little bit more of a practical geopolitical spin put on it, so that you sort of could give it a little more context without having to view it entirely from the perspective of somebody in one first world nation stating what they'd like their local community to be like, which is sort of the bourgeois flaw in all libertarian thought. And from there, I've gone on. I ran actually with a Swedish fellow and a few others, ran a site in the early 2000s, middle 2000s, really, called corrupt.org. And we wrote about very similar topics to the alt-right: human biodiversity, nationalism, transcendental realism, and a focus on restoring the West. And so we were basically a parallel and preceding movement to both neo-reaction and the alt-right.
So does the spelling America, that's how we actually spell it in Sweden, you know that, right? With a K.
Yeah, it was pretty much inspired by the Franz Kafka novel, but it's also, most of our readership has always come from Europe and Japan. So it sort of was designed as a nod to that as well.
Oh, Japan, huh? That's interesting. Why is that, do you think?
I think it just appeals to a certain segment of people who are looking for a more analytical and less emotional take on things, and that appeals to your higher IQ populations. They're looking for people writing about tangible things that one can do with critical analysis that is not really tainted by the bad thought process of this time. And Northern European and Japanese societies retain a fair amount of traditional feeling.
You're right.
And so I think that's why people are inclined to that. We have a lot of people visit from Sweden, and they all speak better English than I do.
You know, I have efficiency, order, structure, discipline. I've noticed a lot of business people in Sweden always do well with actually other Japanese people and stuff like that. There are some commonalities there, so you're absolutely right. Now, let's see here. Let's talk a bit about your book, Nihilism, and what, how you ended up writing the book. When was it released? It was released by Arctos, of course, but I think I was trying to find a date on it here. Was it a year ago or more?
It was a year ago, and it is actually released by Newman Books.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Okay, I thought it was Arctos. Do they republish the book, right?
I don't believe so at this time, though I'd love it if they would. I've known the Arctos guys for a long time. They've always been very supportive of me, and hopefully at some point we'll be able to work together on something.
I don't know why I got that idea. I'm sorry about that. That's my mix-up then. Anyway, do go on.
No worries. It, you know, Arctos has been such an inspiration over the years. They've published so many great things. I wrote the introduction to their compilation of Pentti Linkola essays, which came out in 2011, if memory serves. So I've worked with them for a number of years and really think highly of them. Newman Books is also a longtime collaborator, someone I've written alongside and published with in the past. And she puts out a lot of great writing in the intersection between the occult, traditionalism, and sort of what you might call postmodern philosophy. For lack of a better term. So I've been very fortunate to work with both these groups. This book arose from a collection of essays that I wrote in the early 1990s through late 1990s. And I maybe with a couple outliers that were later, I'd have to go check all the dates. But what I did was compile them in such a way that they led people through the thought process. It's sort of like a descent into what nihilism is. And nihilism requires stepping outside of everything we know entirely as part of the modern world and reorienting thinking toward a more mythological historical view that at first seems very anti-human, but then becomes clear that that's the way that one can know. You can know the inner core of your being through knowing reality. And it's very much a realist philosophy. It's also very much against the usual human drama, the emotions, the judgments, the feelings and desires, all of these things that basically most people react to, and that's how they make decisions. Nihilism is an attempt to get to a clear thinking, a level of realism at which point one is able to understand the beauty of the world and through that reach a transcendental understanding. So it's sort of like going through a black hole. At first, everything is destroyed, and then it's compressed down to this single clear moment. And from there, hopefully on the other side, there's a whole new world to discover. And you're basically viewing the world we live in an entirely different way, at which point you are hopefully awakened from the sleep of modernity.
Very interesting. You know, it's kind of a path that, well, to a certain extent, I've gone through as well, of just kind of hitting rock bottom of really disconnecting from every kind of level of knowledge that, you know, we've ever been given, and just kind of reaching a zero point to a certain extent, and then start from fresh and understanding the world in a new kind of way. So I definitely kind of relate to that. Do you think there was any of the, I don't know, your interest in black metal, death metal, that kind of pulled you in that direction maybe?
Absolutely. I think all of those genres are searching to deconstruct modernity to its roots because they hate it. None of those musicians liked it. They all knew it was a path to death. So they were looking for how do we get to the most basic understanding we can, because all of our knowledge is corrupted. All of it has become infected with this mental virus of, we might call it socializing, or we might call it individualism or solipsism or narcissism or even leftism. It's all the same thing, and it infects our understanding. And so we're trying to get outside of that. And the only way to do that is to just strip everything down to the absolute basics. Nietzsche's reevaluation of all values comes to mind, as well as something you said reminded me, of course, of Milton and Satan being cast out of heaven and finding himself in a brand new world, having to reconstruct everything he knew. So it's got that feel. It's a very Promethean, Faustian approach, which is just when you wake up and find yourself in a time where everything is lies, you have to find some way to destroy all of it and then reinvent what it is to be human, what it is to be a realist, what it is to be logical, what it is to be masculine, and through that rediscover how you want civilization to exist.
It's kind of a breakdown point. I mean, I know, just to make a different kind of analogy to this, this is, of course, how, for example, a military structure operates in many regards. They break down an individual to be able to kind of build them up in their own image to a certain extent. And this, I guess, is also about building up yourself, your own, not only idea of yourself, but your actual self, according to the rules and principles of raw nature and reality itself, correct?
Absolutely. We live now through external selves that are defined by other people and by their concerns and by social tropes and memes. And if you remove those and then are forced to understand yourself on a basic primal animal level, a feral and atavistic level, at that point you start understanding how you can value anything in the first place and start realizing that what you thought were your values and what you thought you actually cared about were in fact extremely false.
Now let me read a little bit from the book, the cover, a little bit as well. While many rail against nihilism as the death of culture and religion, I agree with that. I mean, a lot of people actually on both in the alt-right, they talk about it in these terms. And just to interject here quickly, although I believe that they're correct to a certain extent, it is a kind of a meaninglessness that has inserted itself into modernity, but I think the interpretation of it is wrong. So let me just continue here. The philosophy itself encourages a consequentialist reality-based outlook that forms the basis for moral choice. Unlike the control-oriented system of thought that formed the basis of contemporary society, nihilism reverts the crux of moral thinking to the relationship between the individual and the effects of that individual's actions in reality. From this, a new range of choice expands to affirm religious and moral truth as superior methods of Darwinistic adaptation to the question of human survival, which necessarily includes civilization. So how do you view this thing of many people looking at nihilism as something that now has come to plague our society, and specifically modernity, that there's like, there isn't anything there. There is no, to a certain extent, values there. Some people, I think, they do misappropriate what you said before with what Nietzsche said about the reevaluation of all values. I've seen that there's been a kind of perversion of morality in our society today within modernity. So they take this idea of nihilism and kind of transpose that upon the problems that we see. How would you combat and tackle that?
What they call nihilism, I refer to as fatalism, because it is giving up on the world, giving up on the effects of one's own actions, but it has a covert purpose, which is that when a person says, woe is me, there's nothing I can do, the next thought inevitably that comes out of their mouths is, well, I might as well make myself comfortable. I might as well stop giving a damn about anything and start just focusing on making some money and getting some hookers and blow and some booze or whatever makes them comfortable. And that's the root of degeneracy. They've given up on having a positive effect, and they're focused only on themselves. I track back the failure of the West, the current failure, which we're going to snap out of, and we're going to resurrect the West. I track that failure back to something called hubris, which is what the Greeks identified as the root of evil. And it is to be a desire by the individual to be more important than they are in the grand scheme of things. And with hubris, the individual becomes entirely fixated on the self and entirely neglects the outside world. Plato wrote about this as well. He didn't identify it by that term, but he referred to it as a certain kind of spiritedness focused in the self. And to my mind, all of the ills we face from leftism and before, because the decay, in my view, occurred long before leftism came on the scene, or started occurring, I should say. All of that relates to this hubris, this crazy mixture of narcissism, solipsism, and individualism that causes people to disregard the external world and become navel-gazing, introspective, but not really in a discovery-oriented way, simply fixated on themselves like a closed-circuit television camera. And so I refer to that as fatalism, because I think it's giving up on the possibility of actually having a good life, including a good civilization, and it's giving up for the purpose of writing it off so they don't have to be responsible to it. Now, you mentioned consequentialism, and I think this is one of the most important concepts I deal with. Consequentialism has been redefined to mean preference-based consequentialism, a type of utilitarianism, by most modern sources. That means that if you have a room full of 100 people, you ask them, well, what makes you happy? And whatever they say makes them happy, you assume is the ultimate good. The consequentialism I speak of is the older variety, which is look at the actual results. Instead of filtering it through intermediates and surrogates and proxies like morality, money, popularity, voting, consumerism, whatever, just look at the raw results. Whatever action you take, you know that it's going to be a cause that will have a certain effect. You also know that other people have taken many actions, and you can study what they've done and what the results of those were. So at that point, you just have to go back down the list and say, if I want a certain effect, what are the causes that can produce that? And then you choose those. And by the same token, you can look back and say, well, I can look at how all these actions have occurred in the past and realize that if I do these certain things, these will be the results. And instead of having a morality based on method, where people say, oh, thou shalt not kill, this is a morality based on results entirely and alone, saying, well, if you're going to kill, this is what's going to happen. So then it becomes more important who you're killing, why you're killing them, and what that achieves. Because I think everyone agrees we should kill it sometimes. You know, it's not making a rule like thou shalt not kill makes no sense, because there's a whole bunch of exceptions and footnotes and, you know, side rules to it and all that stuff. And it doesn't really work. What we need instead is something saying, well, what is the result you're aspiring to, and how is that good? And that's what nihilism does. It escapes us from the world of these intermediates And instead, we look purely at consequentialist results.
What about, okay, so how do we solve this issue of like disagreements over the reality of those, not the consequences, but like interpretation of the numbers and the statistics? Now I bring this up because I see part of this, to a certain extent, hopelessness that we find ourselves in today is related to a lot of the not only moral relativism, but also this idea that we can't really know anything. Just a quick example, we had a scandal in Sweden recently with one Czech-Swedish-born author voiced her concerns over what's happening in Sweden with immigration, that people are not feeling safe anymore, crime is on the rise, and these kinds of things. And we had our prime minister speaking out on television this to rebut her claims, because Sweden always gets very concerned when people abroad talk shit about Sweden in one way or another. So they try to correct that very, very fast. But anyway, one of the things he said in there was basically like, well, you know, she's entitled to her opinion and that's fine and we can all voice that. But he tried to argue that there isn't such a thing as reality, that basically whatever you think about stuff, that's just going to be an interpretation of it. It's almost, I mean, to a certain extent, it's a very advanced viewpoint. It's almost like a quantum mechanical viewpoint that's like, well, reality changes itself depending on the observer and this kind of stuff. Obviously, he doesn't go that deep and think about it in those terms. But it's almost like that he's come so far that he can't make a value judgment on any kind of situation. How do you see to combat those kinds of individuals that just don't have a right and wrong compass to navigate through?
Well, I think Nietzsche said there are no truths, only interpretations. And he had a good point, which is that there is no way a human can communicate to another human a truth. This is esotericism in its basic form. Other people have to be able to understand that truth and able to parse it for themselves. And we're all aware of the bell curve, but there's also a certain amount of a learning curve that people have to go through to understand these certain things. And there's no way around the fact that not everyone is going to understand everything. And even more, that for complex issues, it's a very small segment of the population that can understand them. And those people are going to be viewed as crazy or stupid by the rest, because they're just not going to get what these people are going on about. Politicians manipulate that by coming up with good sounding things that make people feel like they can go to sleep and still be happy. It's like, you know, I'm just going to space out and not worry about any of these problems here in the world because they're taken care of by this easy answer. But we can't get around the fact that there's differing interpretations because there's differing abilities among people. And so I would say to the whole, well, we'll just have to agree to disagree thing that you brought up, that most people use. What we really need to do is say instead, when we're looking at any problem, we need to use the best instrument for the task. And that's the smartest people who are also, quite honestly, the most honest. There's no way around moral character. And some people have greater moral character than others. And I think all of us know in life, there's some people we trust. You know, if there's an emergency, there's one neighbor on the block that you're going to go to straight up right away, because you know, not only is this person intelligent, but he or she is also honorable. And so you're not going to have an issue. And I think that's more of an issue here in America, because Sweden, from what I know, has a lot of honorable people. And so you've probably got a bunch of neighbors to go to. But in your average American neighborhood, most people are confused or are slightly deviant or are just useless. And so there's only relatively few people you're going to go toward. And in my experience, it's about 5% of the population that does almost everything that's of actual use. Everyone else might be bulk labor. They might contribute where they can, that kind of thing. But it's basically 1 in 20 people doing just about everything. And you'll notice that matches other formulas like the Pareto principle, where 20% of the people do 80% of the work. Well, as far as the decision making that actually makes things good or bad, I think it's about 5% of the people. And so when you say, are we going to agree to disagree? I say, well, you know, first we've got to set up a hierarchy. You mentioned the military earlier. Absolutely. Spot on. Military and business use functional hierarchies like this. So we need to have a hierarchy where the people who are most competent and most trustworthy are at the top, and they're the ones who are going to make the decisions. And as far as trying to get a room full of people to agree on something, I say that's impossible. Not only do you have the bell curve in effect, where most of them don't understand it or are going to prefer a simplified explanation that misses the point, you also just have the nature of human beings to be very social and to be more focused on compromise and complimenting each other and concerns about, you know, social influences, like who's going to be offended if I say this. So there's no way to really get agreement out of a room full of people. Democracy is nonsense, and a nihilist recognizes this straight up. I mean, you look at this and you're like, there's no way that this could ever work. You need to find the people who have the ability and have the judgment and have the skill. You know, some would call them geniuses. I'd say it's not quite that cleanly defined. It's a mixture of intelligence and just gut instinct and moral character. But you need to find the people who can do things and worry about their interpretation. Because if you try to come up with an interpretation that everyone in the group will like, it's bound to be a lie. So that's my answer to the we have to agree to disagree people.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's tremendously difficult to deal with those people and just at this like nothing guides anything. You can't make any decisions. It's almost like that these people just need to be kind of with force being removed from the situation. These are the people that have attitudes like this that have basically destroyed our society and our civilization. And if good people morally who know they're in the right don't do anything about this, they're going to drive our society completely in the bottom. Where are you on when it comes to, the use of violence and let's say versus the non-aggression principle and these kinds of things? Is there a proper place for force in this worldview?
Absolutely. Because I'm an extreme realist, I know that sometimes it has to happen. You know, here in Texas, if you have a rattlesnake that's 100 feet from your house, you'll do nothing. You might go out there and shoo it away, go away, snake, bye, or whack it with a broom or something. But if you have a rattlesnake in your living room, you're going to kill it. I don't like doing it, but it is the nature of things. You have to do these things. And to me, the question, there is no universal tool. It's as foolish to say I'm against war as I'm for war. Here in America, we have the war on drugs. And they had to make it a war. And you're like, I don't really believe in this making everything into a war. You use the tool that's appropriate for the job. And so if you do have a way of avoiding violence, it makes sense to do that simply because every time you engage in violence, you're rolling the dice. A lot of battle or a lot of combat or even fist fighting is just chance. And so you're going to lose some good people. Even if you do everything right. So you want to minimize that as much as possible. You're also rolling the dice and that chaos is occurring. So I don't believe in the non-aggression principle. I think that's nonsense, sort of like all the other pacifistic stuff. I think it's also bad for the soul. You need to be ready to fight when it's time to fight, but not before. And that's why you first start with very reasoned, gradual solutions, trying to work people towards sanity by showing them what works and by disincentivizing behaviors that reward parasites and the other types of people you mentioned. At some point, you're going to have to say, this is the way the rules are, and some people are going to have to leave. I fully support physical removal of leftists. I hope to do it without violence. Personally, I think all leftists would be much happier in Brazil, for example. It's diverse. It's vibrant. There's lots of ethnic food. There's tons of cool drugs. I mean, it's really their paradise. But, I realized that at some point, if I were saying, I'm going to remove all leftists from North America, some people are going to resist and you're probably going to have to shoot them. And that's just the end result of all things. War is what happens when diplomacy and social order break down. And our social order is pretty much destroyed here. Yeah. But I think there's other ways to handle the problem. Like, for example, the first thing I would do is cut off all the subsidies, the welfare state, the, affirmative action, civil rights, unions, all sorts of things that protect parasitic people. Then I would remove the democratic state so that you stop having these politicians who are parasites doing things to help other parasites. And at that point, I would allow people to get themselves away from the parasites and make it less profitable to be a parasite, and then possibly suggest to them that they need to go elsewhere and that I'd give them a free plane ticket and, maybe a free baggie of weed and coke or something just to get them out of the country. And if they resist it at that point, then it's time to, for machine guns and boxcars, sending them over the border, whatever's required. But you don't want to go to that before you have to. And I think anyone who says they're non-aggression based is probably deluding themselves, because at some point, all of us are aggression based. If you make a rule, that's aggression. If you use economics to make the rule, if you make it with a pen as opposed to a machine gun, it's still going to force someone to obey it. So saying that I admire the libertarians who try to be non-aggression, because I think their intent, they mean well, but I think they've been misled, because non-aggression usually leads to more aggression and then things get out of control. So it's better to just take a gradual approach, move people toward the right place if you can with incentives and disincentives. And then if there's still a problem, you might have to escalate, but not until that point.
The social order is quickly breaking down, and the polarization is also quickly spiraling out of control, as we've seen in America now, of course, after the inauguration of Trump and during as well, and afterwards, and the Milo thing, and the attacks at Berkeley and all this kind of stuff. It's just absolutely crazy what's happening right now. And I think at the end of it, regardless of the ideas that humans have and what we think is good and what feels good for us temporarily or in the short term, that doesn't matter. I mean, I think at the end of the day, nature is going to win, regardless of what we think is important. We might have our ideas, as I said, but, you know, if something doesn't operate within the structure of nature, we might think that we can bypass it for a time, and we might be able to bypass it for a time. But frankly, I think, Brett, that we're heading in a direction right now where a lot of these things combined, it's a kind of a convergence point to a certain extent, is just going to lead to complete social breakdown of law and order and of society and everything else. And at that point, we will have to see what the rules really are, right? For survival, for what works and what doesn't work. I don't think you can have a society where that's on the brink of collapse or that is at the precipice and still uphold, you know, I don't know, some tranny operations or something, or transitional, you know, government-sponsored transition operations, or LGBTQ rights, or the females need to get this and this for free. It's just, it's going to restore itself very quickly to a natural order that has worked throughout history, like the family unit and like certain traditional aspects of handling things. So to a certain extent, I mean, I wish we don't have to get to that point, but part of me kind of want to see it get to that point as well, because it would show us once again of what actually really works. And I think that we would also realize that modernity itself has just been a kind of a footnote really in human history. But what do you think about this?
I think modernity has clearly been a wrong turn. Everything we formalized, starting with the Enlightenment, has been a lie. And even before that, with the peasant revolts and some of the earlier changes, we were clearly going down a wrong path. The thing is, for me, that it's really a question if we want to survive. Nature will restore balance, but nature tends to downgrade things in complexity if they don't fight for their own survival. An eagle that does not strictly fight to be elitist and to be above the rest of the birds and to be a top predator is going to end up a sparrow in a few thousand generations. And I think that's what's happening in the West right now. But the other thing I wanted to add is that most people view nature as something arbitrary. They view it as just being nature. It just does its thing for reasons unknown. But the fact is, nature is a supremely brilliant design that's highly efficient, highly redundant, has localized failure, and works extremely well as a result. It's just humans have given themselves the power to rise above this. You know, when you think about civilizations, they start out, everybody's starving, and they have to do some hunting and get organized and build sewers and all the things that increase survival so that people can get along and increase in number. The problem is that at that point, they're subsidizing lots of people who are delusional, and eventually they collapse. Well, sort of the task for us is, now that we've mastered nature, is to go back and understand nature and stop pushing against it, so that instead we can have an order that's coherent with nature, consistent with nature, and understands what makes nature so successful, instead of creating our own order based on human intent and human feelings and that kind of thing that is contradictory to nature and even more to the logic that underlies nature. And there's a reason, for example, for tribalism or nationalism, as we like to call it. It works best. It's most efficient if creatures are able to recognize those like them and work together on a team. That way they have to spend a lot less effort constantly defending themselves, and individuals can collaborate together. So you can build civilization. Without that, you cannot start a civilization. There has to be some way that the group strongly identifies as itself, and genetics is the usual way. Well, we've turned our back on that because, hey, we've got all this money and power and we can make it work. Well, now we're seeing that that's failed. And I think that 2016 really was a watershed for the West. I think we saw so many things failing at once, and we saw Brexit and Trump on the horizon, and it became clear that this order we've been pursuing since the Enlightenment is not working. Not only is it anti-nature, it's anti-realistic. It's not logical, given all of the inputs we need. We can always construct a mental model in our heads that makes these things seem to work, but it involves leaving out key information, cherry picking, in other words, in order to make it seem like it'll work. And that's what we've done. The Enlightenment was a giant assumption that all humans had reason and that we could build a society based on reason alone. Well, now we're seeing that arc come to its conclusion, And the answer is that it makes society hell and everybody's existentially miserable and the intelligent people are dying out from drugs and suicide and other things. So we need to go back. We've taken a wrong turn. We need to go back and get back on the path we were on and then extend in a different direction and go someplace better. And I think I completely agree with you. I think there's been a massive denial of the wisdom underlying nature in the West. In fact, it's a bigotry. And I always compare it to Tolkien, the Lord of the Rings. The one ring of power makes people able to act well above their station in the hierarchy. You have that ring, you can turn yourself invisible, you can do anything. And I think that's the kind of illusion we've been pursuing. That's the hubris I talk about. People in the West have been trying to make themselves more powerful than they are. And I think that manifests in a form of revenge against nature. This is more Nietzsche again. People want to destroy nature. They want to destroy the beautiful. They want to destroy social order and anything true because it is above themselves. They are like the mythological Satan. None shall come before me. I am the first and foremost. Well, that doesn't work unless you're God. And most people, I think, on some level, secretly believe they are God. And that is the root of our problem.
Interesting. You know, we have academic dishonesty on top of this. We've moved back and forth within the official academic world on what we know about certain things. And you know, right now we're in a situation where we, for example, are moving away, it looks like, from even Darwinism and these kinds of things. Even alternative ideas are sneaking in there. I've seen reports on things such as cooperation between nature. They take examples like when the lion do lies next to the lamb, those one instances that's happened, and kind of as proof for the fact that nature is actually not what we thought it was. This is, of course, very, very disingenuous. It's manipulative, to say the least. But my point is, most people don't know this, right? I mean, they think from a scientific point of view. You have things such as Discovery Channel or you know, D-Science that's on YouTube right now, for example, debunking these things about old race, you know, realism and these kinds of things, or the existence of gender. In other words, we have a dishonest academic community that's leading people down the wrong path, and this is being reinforced both by the media and popular culture. And it's very difficult for us, for people like us, to say that no, actually, there is a scientific truth here, which is very different than the one that's currently being pushed. So that's another issue, an element and layer on top of this, as you said, beyond politicians. It's academics, it's media, pop culture, right?
Indeed. And I think one of the most useful things that we got out of Neo-Reaction was this simple revelation. Everything is a business, or at least acts like one. Government is a business. Academia is a business. Media is a business. And so they are going to sell a product that draws any audience that's large enough to support them. They don't care who it is. They're not looking for the best people. They're not looking for the sane people. They just need a certain number of warm bodies to show up and buy the product. And so academia is preaching what most people want to believe. When you think about it, your average person or your average group of people, they want to believe that they don't have to actually take any affirmative steps to improve their world. They don't want to believe that this nature thing is real and that at any minute predation can happen, that we can be found wanting, that we can challenge ourselves with external reality and fail. They don't want to believe that. They want to believe in a world where nobody fails, nobody fights, everything's happy. We all just go to our jobs and buy stuff and then have nice, happy lives, even if that's soul-killing and empty, because they are afraid. And these academia, government, media, they sell products designed to assuage fear. They're geared toward making people feel safe about being mediocre or the possibility that they're mediocre. For most people, they actually aren't as mediocre as they think, but they're more afraid than they are, than is real. And so what they're doing is buying these products by, you know, their clicks, their eyeballs, their votes, whatever, because that's what they want to believe. And so while I think academia is toxic as hell at this point, we have to look to the root of the problem, which is that there's a huge audience of people out there who want to believe something delusional. And until we have a hierarchy that enforces, let's just say, clearer statements of realism, these people are going to continue purchasing illusion products because they deal with the fears that they have on a regular basis.
I want to frame this in the context of democracy and equality and talk a bit about the problem with democracy, because I think obviously it would maybe work if we only solely had a really informed people that actually knew what they were deciding on and actually looked into issues and things like this. So I'm totally with you on that idea that it's like these ideas doesn't work unless you have actually highly intelligent people. We probably only have to have also more or less a homogenous people within a country that makes decisions together, even if that, you know, is going to work in itself. But take the situation with Trump, right? The media, I mean, they lied so tremendously about him that most people that I think that are today out in the streets and protesting him and protesting his presidency and some of his decisions and everything else, they do that solely on the basis that they are completely misinformed by mainstream media. And they are actually the ones that have been ramping up this violent and protests that we're seeing right now. What do you think about the situation of just how they have completely lied about him and made connections that aren't there? It's misunderstandings, it's exaggerations. And I think they've done it solely to actually win politically from their point of view. What do you think?
I agree. They're totally lying. But then again, I don't think this is anything new. The media has always been a profit-driven business. And as long as it finds people that are willing to purchase its product, it will tell them whatever it wants to, whatever it thinks they will purchase. There's this illusion that the media exists to tell you the truth, but they have absolutely no obligation under law or under business to do so. All they have to do is say things that people want to hear, or I should say enough people want to hear. And so they're always going to lie, and they're lying about Trump. They lied about the lead up to the election. They have lied about numerous other things. I mean, you think about climate change, for example. Do we know if this is true or not? Well, who trusts the press? They all seem to be in favor of it. So there's a lot of distrust there. But I think you hit on a couple really interesting points. One is, in my mind, based on a study of history and simple logical fact, the only societies that function at all are those that are ethnically homogenous. You simply need everybody going in the same direction. And culture is as much a genetic thing as anything else. I mean, you have people of similar ability, of similar inclinations. They like the same foods. They like the same rhythms and music. They have the same rough outlook toward life, the same attitude. For example, Swedish people have this unquantifiable attitude toward life that's both pessimistic and extremely positive. You know, you don't find that anywhere else. It's very unique to that population, but that's what keeps people working together. And there's a cybernetic model for it. And that is that if you view people as different threads running in a program, you want to minimize the amount of communication they have to do between each other, because that causes slowdowns and stoppage and that kind of thing. Well, culture means you have a set of shared assumptions and behaviors, and you don't have to communicate those. You don't have to say, well, what are we going to put on the menu? It's like, well, we're going to put our traditional ethnic foods on this menu, because that way we always know what to do and we don't have to stop and have a debate and fight it out, that kind of thing. Nope. We're all coming from the same place, heading toward roughly the same place. We can work together. So I think whether it's a democracy or not, any society that wants to thrive, at least in the long term, needs to be ethnically homogenous. The other thing you said, and I'm going to differ here, if you had a democracy just of intelligent people, maybe it would work. And I would point toward the American experiment here. Originally, the only people voting in America were landowning males over 30. That meant a very select group of wealthy and successful people, also generally your smartest people in the group. At the same time, that didn't work. Somehow, they were conned themselves or something into passing rules and laws and bills that eventually dismantled that franchise and incorporated people into it who didn't understand it. And from there, everything went downhill. And early critics of democracy, such as Alexis de Tocqueville, pointed out that this was likely to happen. And I think it always happens. The problem is that we have to look at how people make decisions in groups. And I think even if they're really smart and really nice people, in a group, the tendency is to compromise, and the tendency is not to say things that you know are going to upset other people. And if you're looking into actually making a decision that's functional, you're going to have to face especially all the things that upset us and scare us. So even if you have a group of highly intelligent people together, you're probably going to get a bad decision. In fact, you may get a worse one, because by the nature of them being intelligent, they're probably going to consider lots of other things, and they can launch off on many different tangents.
Yeah.
So I wish I thought there was a way for democracy to work. I think the American Constitution is a beautiful document and a noble attempt. But I think as of 2016, it's been proven that it doesn't work. Democracy leads to terrible results. And some people would say, well, look at the election of Donald J. Trump. I mean, here we see a rejection of all the horrors of the Obama years. And I'm saying, well, this is what happened. I mean, we basically hit rock bottom in this nation. People are overdosing on opiates on the street. Crime is out of control. Corruption is out of control. Most people would not even recognize this country from where it was a generation ago. It is just devastated after the Clinton years. And so I'm glad that we elected Donald Trump. I think it's a wonderful first step. But the fact is, we're trying to undo up to 200 years of terrible decision-making in one election with one man. And that's not going to work. I think if anything, this election says we can't make the process of compromise itself leads to bad results, and we can't make it work, even among good, nice people. I'm not trying to insult people here or be unduly misanthropic. I will admit to some misanthropy, but that's mostly because I believe in human quality control. But the thing is, even in a group of good people, there's going to be that tendency to compromise and that exhaustion with fighting it out and that desire to not upset other people. And it just leads away from the truth. And you do it little decision by little decision over the years. And then some point down the line, you find yourself acting entirely on assumptions that are shared like viruses through social contact and through language. You find yourself acting entirely on these assumptions, and they're complete lies. When you think about what the average American politician has to do now, it's like, here we have thousands and thousands of laws, all of which are based on lies. We have national slogans that we use, like diversity is our strength, which is a lie. We have other assumptions, like that everyone is somehow equal and equal in reason and equally able to be reasoned with. Those are lies. And so you have this giant pile of lies, and that basically creates something that's sort of like a really bad board game called Navigate the Lies, where you have to sort of thread the different lies together in a way that sort of gets closer to something that's good. But each time you make a decision that turns toward the good, it creates more lies. I think of the Reagan-Thatcher years in this. They'd fix one thing, and in doing so, they'd break 10 others. And then as soon as they were out of the way, the leftists came in and exploited all of those things, just ran wild with them. You know, Reagan, for example, was one of our first immigration amnesties. So it's, I don't know if democracy can ever be made to work, because I don't know if group decision making can ever be made to work, if you know what I mean.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point, because, you know, I wanted to ask you about this, if this makes your philosophy one of basically just it makes it an individual journey, because if there's issues of compromise, you quickly derail into lies and stuff like that. However, let's juxtapose that then to the predicament that we find ourselves in today. Take this issue of, for example, individualism in the West as one of the highest, you know, values that we have. This is, of course, mostly then concerned with most white people. They're the ones who, you know, value individualism. We fight on an individual level. Most people, whether they be cucks or, you know, well, leftists to a certain extent, they are into identity politics. So I shouldn't say that, but most people are more conservative, shall we say. They have this attitude of, well, you know, I don't care about, you know, color or where people come from or whatever, just as long as they, you know, adopt our precious values of the West, and they'll be fine. They'll fit right in and stuff like that. But the problem is that we have all these other groups working collectively together against us, right? While we are denied to have a collective identity and to have that, you know, to basically make a group compromise in order to be able to fight on a collective level against them. I think we'll probably always lose on an individual level, and the group in itself will always be much more powerful. I see us in a position now, whether we at the end of the day want to have a collectivist society or not, but I see right now there is a great need for collectivism of white people, of people of European descent, to realize that they are targeted not only by all these other you know, groups that work on an ethnic level against us, but by the globalists themselves. So what do you think about that kind of dilemma that we're in right now?
Well, I think it's important to separate identity and identitarianism from collectivism. Collectivism is the idea that society owes an obligation to all of its members and is going to support them in some way, and that they're able to externalize the costs of their existence to the social collective for the purpose of making them equal. So collectivism, which is basically what happens when you get a group of individualists together, is actually the opposite of what we're talking about. When we talk about identity, we're saying people giving up some individuality to work, not necessarily for the group, but for the organic ideal of civilization itself. So that means that we're able to have internal disagreements, and we're able to say some people who are of our group don't belong here with us. And we're not required to subsidize everyone, but we're all working toward the same goal, unequally, We're all going to serve different roles. We have different abilities, and we work toward the same basic end. For example, you know, let's talk about what Sweden is. Sweden is a place. Sweden is a concept. Sweden is a feeling in the heart. Sweden is an idea. You know, it's a, I shouldn't say a concept, it's a cluster of concepts. But it's also a goal. You know, you say, what do? I fight for Sweden. That doesn't just mean the land. It doesn't just mean the people as they are now. It means the past, present, and future. It means the ideals. It means the spirit. It means the living sense of what it is to be that people. And that is identity. And collectivism is the opposite thing. It's saying, we're not fighting for Sweden as this ideal. We're not fighting to make Sweden better. We're fighting for all these people here just to make them comfortable and to make sure that everybody is equally included. When in fact, what that does is shift the goal from Sweden to this sense of everybody who's here right now that we need to rely on for political purposes. So I would say those are two separate things. The concept you brought up earlier is what Peter Brimelow, who's the writer over at VDare.com, who's a great writer, a truly great writer, who's done a lot of great work for many, many years, he calls the proposition nation. And this is the idea, and it's very popular with American conservatives, God help them, who want to think that if you just get people in and teach them the same language, teach them the same rules, get them introduced to the same economic system, everything's going to work out just fine. They'll become just like us. And of course, that's destructive on many levels. It destroys identity. So there's no longer a sense of America. You know, in the past, when you said, are you going to fight for America? I'm thinking of all my neighbors, people like me, who share the same values and goals and basic attributes. And I say, sure, I'll fight for those people and I'll die for them. But you say, now, are you going to fight for America? I see basically a big open air shopping mall filled with people from all over the world who have nothing in common except that they like buying things and they like living under this legal system and this political system because it keeps them safe in their view. And so I don't think anyone would fight for that. America is more than a place. It's a concept. I mean, America is Davy Crockett. It's Daniel Boone. It's Remember the Alamo. It's the Revolution. It's the battle against the biggest military power on earth at the time for independence. It's a lot of things. But really, we're a nation of Western Europeans. And without that identity, there's no reason for any of our cultural choices, and there's no reason to really work toward improving ourselves or toward perpetuating ourselves. We need that organic sense of identity, and that's the opposite of the collective. Conservatives, in many ways, are arguing for something a lot like Soviet communism. They're saying, we bring everybody in, we teach them the right propaganda, they become good communists, and then they become Americans, and everything's fine. And what they're going to do is act as a collective, or this mass united by basically economic need, and we're going to manipulate them that way, and we're going to force them all to support each other, and that's how we'll keep this nation going. We don't need an ethnic identity, when in fact, as history shows us, the happiest nations through all time have been the ones that have had the most similarity and have required the least amount of this force, this control, to get people who are basically not really heading in the same direction to work together as a collective. So when you hear collective, I would say instead mob, herd, crowd, gang, cult, those kind of words. That's what they're thinking with collectivism. And it's a very hard term to define because, of course, you're not going to get a straight answer from academia or media about it. But a little analysis will show, I think, that I'm correct on that point.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think we've definitely seen the cult-like behavior of the leftists and the liberals been out protesting Trump afterwards. I'm sure you saw the art installation by Shia LaBeouf, whatever his name is.
Who knows?
He will not divide us. My God, you've seen these people just ranting and just like droning on these words, and it's like some kind of chant or something. I feel creeped out when I watch it.
Yeah, they're crazy. I remember the first time I encountered a hardcore liberal as a kid. We were driving on the freeway and we went past this car that was literally covered with bumper stickers. Save the whales, you know, save the Indians, we can all coexist, that kind of thing. And I was just trying to, you know, I'm asking my parents, I'm like, what's going on in that weird car? You know, why does this person feel a need to broadcast all of this stuff? And of course, they couldn't answer because they were mostly leftists themselves. But the fact is, these people base their identity and their existence in ideology. And ideology is a way of saying, we think this is how things should be. And it is the exact opposite of nihilism and conservatism, right-wing beliefs, and realism, which is, this is how things are. here's how we're going to adapt to them and gradually improve. So it's the exact opposite. And by that very nature, they are reality deniers. They hate reality. They feel it hates them, and they want to destroy it. And so there is in them this pathology to tear down everything beautiful, everything good, and everything true. And they that includes, you know, happy groups of Swedish people, Swedish families, happy Americans, people who aren't miserable. And so they're basically spreading misery and destruction, not because they're nihilists, but because they're fatalists. They have given up on everything but their own egos, and they're angry at the world because it hasn't made them God, and they want to be God. And so when I look at Sheila, what's his name, Sheila douchebag, you know, I see this guy who's basically an attention whore. He makes his money by attention whoring in Hollywood. I don't really pay attention to mainstream entertainment, so I have no idea what the guy's done, but I know he's an actor. And so what he's doing is trying to get other people to have emotional experiences with him. They're all going to get together and they're going to emote about, oh, he won't divide us. He won't divide us. Well, like all leftist ideas, this one is based in circular reasoning. He's forcing onto us the assumption that we are not already divided. But the fact is we're already entirely divided. People in America have nothing in common. You know, you drive down the freeway and you're surrounded by people from all over the world. And true, they just want to go to their jobs too. They just want to be safe. They want their kids to be educated, to be successful. That's great. But those are very surface things, if you know what I mean. Those are very external. All the things that guide the soul, that actually matter to people and that make them feel that their lives are worth living, those things are not shared. And so at this point, I think, you know, if we had another world war where everybody was like, all right, all men sign up and let's go charge off and defeat whoever it is this time, I don't think you'd see Americans signing up for it. I think we'd all be heading to the hills, because the answer is, who am I really fighting for and what am I fighting for? And the answer is, I'm fighting for a job, some shopping, and a little bit of legal protection that doesn't even work all that well. That's nothing to fight for. And so that's why, well, I think this is why the modern leftist is so geared against identity. They want us to live in this chaos, in this miserable state, and to essentially require ideology for meaning in our lives. And that's what I see in a guy like Sheila Douchebag. He's out there trying to find meaning in life, false meaning, through ideology, and have other people share in that so that they feel a sense of togetherness. But it's about feelings. It's not about reality.
Yeah, you know, that is also what the left wanted, right? The Marxists, the cultural Marxists, they wanted to break down the nation state in this way. I think the goal has never been to actually build a utopia. This is just the carrot they use to get people to go along with their idea of demolishing everything that they see as you know, violating their terms. I firmly agree that they hate nature, they hate order, they hate everything, you know, beauty and these kinds of things. It is a truly resentment for reality itself and nature itself. And actually, in the second segment, Brett, when we continue, I want to ask you more about this, of actually what's at the end of the road there for them in their philosophy. What are some of the tools they're going to use at their disposal to not only enforce this vision, but to maybe even transform themselves towards this, I don't know, genderless, raceless nothingness that they have at the end of this road here. I personally think they will probably implement things such as transhumanism, but we can get into that more in the second segment and discuss that more in detail then. It'll be interesting. But give people an idea of where they should go to pick up a copy of the book. Tell us a bit more about the website. You started a podcast recently as well, so give us the details about that.
Yes, the podcast has been a lot of fun. I'm working with Everett Foster, Roderick Kane, who many of you know is out of Visionary, the neo-reactionary writer who wrote the book called Smart and Sexy about differences in ability between the genders, between the sexes.
And that one was by Arctos, right, wasn't it?
That one was most definitely by Arctos.
There we go. So maybe I because I just looked at some of his work as well, and for a moment I might have confused the publisher. Anyway, go ahead.
Very, very easy to confuse, and things are extremely chaotic out there, especially on my websites. But anyway,
looks good.
Yeah, thank you. But we're working together doing this podcast. On our first podcast, we are joined by a fellow named Peter Vilzik, who's a philosophy student who contributed a lot as far as cooling down the rest of us, because we're basically ready for complete society makeover. I guess sounds like a Hollywood show, civilization makeover. But
that's
anyway,
about time. I'd sign up for that. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I wish they had stuff like that on TV. I might buy one.
Yeah, exactly.
But But yeah, we do about an hour of just banter on alt-right topics, and it's got a philosophical bent, but also touches on a fair amount of literature and just general practical value topics. I mean, it's not, it doesn't require any special preparation to listen to, and we've done our first episode, and I think it turned out pretty well. Nobody got killed anyway, and so far no one's contacted us to say we're going straight to jail for what we said, so we think that's fairly successful so far.
So you're cucks, that's what you're saying. No, making a joke. Yeah, no.
Yeah, we refer to ourselves as navigating between cuck and spurg.
Right. Yeah, I heard that. That's right.
Yeah, there's, you know, on the cuck side, you have the people who just want everything to work out well without any conflict. And I understand their perspective. I don't think it works. So I've rejected it because I'm a nihilist. And on the other side, you have spurg, which are people who take certain things too far and don't quite miss the bigger picture. For example, I'm totally conversant with all of the details about the differences between ethnic groups, social classes, the sexes, you have it. I don't focus on these things because to me it's become clear that without a nationalist, culture-driven society that's ruled by aristocrats, has some kind of internal hierarchy and caste system, and has some kind of transcendental goal, we're screwed. There's basically, when we say that history is cyclic, what we're saying is there's definitely a right way to do things. And if you back off of that right way of doing things, you're going to go through a cycle of decay until you hopefully rediscover it. And if you don't, you're going to end up a third world remnant of a once great civilization, as we see all over the goal, as Spengler mentioned. And so with our podcast, we're trying to explore more of these ideas and not get into the spurg, because the spurg goes too far. It fixates, like an autistic person might, on one of the details and misses the big picture. So it is a big picture show, and it's designed to be fairly entertaining. And sometimes I believe there's beer and firearms involved, so it's very Texas.
Very good. Sounds interesting. So check it out, folks. You can find more, of course, at America.org, and also take a look at the book Nihilism, A Philosophy Based in Nothingness and Eternity. Brett shows a clips on the front cover as well. Looks like a little bit like the first draft of the logo that we used for a while. We of course still have an eclipse as the logo, but that's good stuff. Definitely check it out, ladies and gentlemen. We'll have links up to that. But yeah, we'll take a short break here. We're going to continue with Brett Stevens in the second segment. Stay tuned, everyone. We will be right back. Tune into the second hour of this show. Sign up for a membership with Red Ice. Stream or download any of the shows straight from the site, both hours, and also our 314 shows, and this includes the video version of the shows as well. If you prefer, we also have RSS feeds with all the shows, either the 50 latest or divided up by year, so you can go back and download any of them with your favorite podcatcher or a podcast feed reader. Whatever is more convenient for you, we have it all provided on the members' website. You also get access to exclusive material like our live TV show, Weekend Warrior. You can watch that live too, by the way. tune in and chat with other members. You also get access first to other segments and shows such as Norse News and other video material that we produce. So head on over to redicemembers.com, sign up, support, and help us grow. Thank you. We'll talk more with Brett Stevens after the break.